Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning.
Good morning.
So last night, Genzawe Sesshin wrapped up. We sat retreat for 5 days, and each night, Kakemyo gave us an elegant teisho on a fascicle of Dogen Shobo Genzo. And this year he was speaking on ungraspable mind. And that fascicle has a lot of links to the Diamond Sutra. So we also got a lot from the Diamond Sutra. And although I teach here, I also teach out in Sandy with a small sitting group out there. And we're about to start an advanced studies class on the Diamond Sutra. So I've been spending a lot of time with the Diamond Sutra. So listening to Kakemyo talk about it was lovely. It was very nice. But in preparing for this class out in Sandy, I asked the students, the participants, to do a reading assignment and send in reflection papers. So nothing super academic, but just, what is it that became alive for them as they read these sections in the Diamond Sutra? We just had the first 4 chapters to read, so it wasn't a long reading assignment. But this gives me an idea to see how people are interacting with the text. Are they reading this sutra with an academic view, with a critical view, with a personal view, with a contemplative view? It gives me a chance to read the room or the group of the students. So when the first class starts this afternoon, there's an ability to lean into what it is that they need. And so in one of these reflection papers, a student asked a question, and I found it to be fascinating. It was this question of, how do you let go? So I was like, oh, I want to do a Dharma talk on how do you let go. What is this all about? How do we do this? And so I went to the student and said, hey, can I use your question for a Dharma talk? I'd like to use it to build a talk around for Sunday. And they said, sure. But that wasn't my question. Oh. My question was, how do you know something's disappeared? Oh, that's a different question. But then I became fascinated with the fact that I missed. You know, we talk about arrows meeting in midair, and that's a rare event, right? Arrows meeting in midair. It's something to be celebrated. Like when you're in the Sanzen room and that meets, yes. This was not that. But that's what we do, right? This is like 99% of our experience is not arrows meeting in midair. So with that in mind, and with this interaction happening sort of in the midst of this Sesshin container, Sesshin provided a wonderful example to look at what is happening with the mind. What are we doing internally? One of the things I learned early on in training is the fact that all of my perceptions come into my conscious awareness already having come through karmic filters. And that was somewhat of a painful realization, that what comes to my mind is already tainted by my past karma. So with that in mind, and going back to this question of how do you know something has disappeared, it brings up this this question of Buddhist epistemology. How do we know what we know? How do we discern? So I spent some time this week with Dharmakirti and Dignaga, who were old Indian Buddhist philosophers. And Dreyfus, writing about Dharmakirti, says, "Perception is a cognition that is unmistaken and free from conceptions." For the Buddhist epistemologist, perception is differentiated from other cognitions primarily by its non-conceptual character. Conception does not apply to the individual reality of phenomena, but addresses their general characteristics. Since these are only constructs, they cannot be true reflections of reality. For perception to be undistorted, therefore, it must be totally free from conceptual elaborations. This implies a radical separation between perception, which holds the object as it is in its perceptual ken, and the interpretation of this object, which introduces conceptual constructs into the cognitive process. This requirement that perception be non-conceptual is the cornerstone of Buddhist theory of perception. So what he's talking about here is that perception is not flavored by concepts. For something to be a pure perception, it is not flavored by concepts. So our senses take in sense data, and it comes into the sense consciousness. And then our minds apply meaning and interpretation on top of that, and it comes into awareness. This is a very sort of basic summary of that. So part of this is important because, actually a lot of this is important because we think that what we see is how things are. We think that what we perceive is reality. Dharmakirti says again, perception is a cognition that is unmistaken and free from conceptions. But that's not how most of us walk through our lives, seeing so clearly, hearing so clearly, understanding so clearly. Arrow's missing, right? Things appear and disappear due to karmic causes and conditions. Things appear and disappear because we perceive them to appear and disappear. And if our perception, our ideas of perception, are not clear, then that karmic flavoring takes a greater taint, a greater obscuration. And it becomes hard. It becomes hard to see clearly. We create habits around not seeing clearly. And this is why Sesshin is great. We get a chance to sit for a week and watch delusions arise again and again and again. There it is, there it is, there it is. Come back, come back, come back. Brush things away. Let go of the story. So within this chapter that we studied this week, see, in Sesshin, you don't have all these papers to juggle. So in this chapter this week, Dogen was commenting on a phrase that reads, the past mind is ungraspable, the present mind is ungraspable, the future mind is ungraspable. So we spent a lot of time hearing from Kakumyo talking about ungraspable mind. So within that chapter, that phrase comes at the end of a chapter. But at the beginning of the chapter, there's a discussion of the Buddha's five eyes, And I remember Kyogen talking about this a long, long time ago when I was new to practice. And he had this great system of relating the Buddha's five eyes to the five ceremonies of Jikai, to the five types of Zen, to the skandhas. There's one more set of five. He had like all of these five sets of five linked.
Five ranks.
Five ranks, thank you. And I was new to practice, and I remember thinking, that's so cool. I have no idea what he's talking about. No idea what he's talking about. So as I went through training, you know, there's this thing about the Buddha's five eyes, and I can't remember where it came from. It was in this mixed of a list of five things. So I was delighted in starting to work with the Diamond Sutra again to stumble upon this teaching of the Buddha's five eyes. So I'm just going to read you this chapter and some of the commentary around the Buddha's five eyes. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a physical eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a physical eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a divine eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a divine eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a prajna eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a prajna eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a dharma eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a dharma eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? Does the Tathagata possess a Buddha eye? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan. The Tathagata possesses a Buddha eye. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? As many grains of sand as there are in the great river of the Ganges, does the Tathagata not speak of them as grains of sand? Subhuti replied, so he does, Bhagavan, so he does, Sugata. The Tathagata speaks of them as grains of sand. The Buddha said, what do you think, Subhuti? If there were as many rivers as all the grains of sand in the great river of the Ganges, and as many worlds as there are grains of sand in all those rivers, would there be many worlds? Subhuti replied, so there would, Bhagavan. So there would, Sugata. There would be many worlds. And the Buddha said, as many beings as there might be in those worlds, Subhuti, I would know their myriad streams of thought. And how so? Streams of thought, Subhuti, what the Tathagata speaks of as streams of thought are no streams. Thus they are called streams of thought. And how so? Subhuti, a past thought cannot be found, a future thought cannot be found, nor can a present thought be found. So that's what Dogen took as a past mind cannot be found, a present mind cannot be found, a future mind cannot be found. So the sutra does not explain these five eyes. Reading straight through the Diamond Sutra, it's like, the Buddha's five eyes. And then nothing. Come on. But fortunately, Red Pine has gathered a great number of commentaries on the Diamond Sutra. And these talk about the five eyes. These are teachers of old who have studied this and said, here's some help. Here's some help to help you understand. So the physical eye, the fleshly eye, perceives objects in the realm of desire, but only their external aspect. The physical eye sees the near but not the far, the front but not the back, the outside but not the inside, the light but not the dark, the top but not the bottom. Because it is obstructed, a bodhisattva seeks the divine eye. So the physical eye, the fleshly eye, I think we're familiar with that one, the one in which we see the world. We see what's in front of us, nothing else. Looking at Gemon, I cannot see her back, only her front. So because it is obstructed, a bodhisattva seeks the divine eye. The divine eye is the first of six supernatural powers acquired by those whose spiritual practice is centered around meditation, and it continues to be cultivated by members of many religious traditions. So, Sashin, good. We're going to cultivate some powers. So the divine eye sees both the near and the far, the front and the back, the outside and the inside, the light and the dark, the top and the bottom, all without obstruction. But the divine eye only sees those provisionally named things that result from the combination of causes and conditions, and not their true appearance, not their emptiness or their formlessness, their non-existence, their birthlessness, or their deathlessness. The same holds for their past, their present, and their future. Hence the bodhisattva seeks the prajna eye. So the dharma eye is not enough, not sufficient. But the dharma eye sees things in relation to karma, how things are connected. So the prajna eye perceives objects in the realm of formlessness. It perceives their essential emptiness. The prajna eye does not see beings, for all common and differentiating characteristics are extinguished. It is free of all attachments and immune to all dharmas, including prajna itself. But because it does not distinguish anything, the prajna eye cannot liberate other beings. Hence, the bodhisattva gives rise to the dharma eye. So here, the prajna eye is the eye that sees emptiness, the eyes that sees the sameness of all things. But once again, according to the teachings of the sutra, not enough. The dharma eye perceives the means to liberate others and is only possessed by bodhisattvas. The dharma eye enables a bodhisattva to cultivate a dharma and to realize a path, as well as to know the expedient means by which other beings can do so. The dharma eye is concerned with the truth of provisional reality and the reality of appearances. But the dharma eye, however, is not omniscient in awareness of the expedient means for liberating beings. Hence, a bodhisattva seeks the Buddha eye. So the dharma eye sees provisional reality, sees things not just as empty, but also here, conventional truth. The Buddha eye sees everything, including whatever is seen by the other four eyes. It not only sees things in the present, it also sees them in the past and in the future. With their prajna eye, Buddhas see the emptiness of all things, and with their dharma eye, they see their underlying appearance. But with their Buddha eye, they see the middle path between these two, whereby the doctrines of emptiness and dharma reality merge into the path of non-duality. Shakyamuni acquired this eye on the night of his enlightenment. There is nothing unknown to the Buddha eye. Though it might be completely obstructed, it can see everything. What to others is distant, to a Buddha is near. What to others is dark, to a Buddha is bright. What to others is confused, to a Buddha is distinct. What to others is fine, to a Buddha is coarse. What to others is profound, to a Buddha is shallow. There is nothing of which the Buddha eye does not learn, nothing it does not see, nothing it does not know, nothing that is difficult, and yet nothing that is perceived. The Buddha eye shines forever upon all dharmas. So those are the Buddha's five eyes. And one of the commentators says, all of those five eyes exist below the eyebrows, which I found reassuring. So the Diamond Sutra is a sutra that belongs to a class of sutras called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. These teachings are often considered to be the teachings of emptiness. And in the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, which is part of this sutra collection, there's a quote that I've always loved that reads, change and no change, suffering and ease, self and not self, the lovely and repulsive, just one suchness and emptiness they are. So this quote lists the four perverted views, the ways in which we mistake reality, mistaking no change for change, for ease for suffering, the not self for self, and the repulsive for lovely. And yet, just one suchness in this emptiness they are. So being able to see things as empty, and also seeing that vibrant, dynamic, unique, momentary preciousness of things as they are. This is what we're pointing to, we're talking about when we're pointing to suchness. So why is this important? Going back to that misunderstanding of the student's question, that misperceiving of what the question was, what the intention was, what the need was. We do this a lot, and yet sometimes it's not a bad thing. We misunderstand or we misperceive, and sometimes something beautiful arises. There's a story that when Dogen was enlightened, he was hearing words meant for another student. And there's even a story that says he misheard the words that were meant for another student. But it worked for him. Those words might not have been the words that Rujing said, but Dogen understood them in a way that worked for him, that was true for him, that was beneficial for him. So even though we misperceive, it's not necessarily a bad thing. In this case, misapprehending the student's question, it allowed for further inquiry. It allowed for further investigation. It allowed for more building of relationship. I trust that the student's going to say, no, that wasn't my question. And the student can trust that I can say, huh, okay, let's look at that. We build relationship that way. But in looking at this teaching of the Buddha's five eyes, these five ways of viewing the world, these five ways of perceiving what's going on around us, including perceiving our own sense of ourselves. We often make assumptions without inquiry. So you're walking down a street and someone is approaching you and they have on a red hat with four words in white letters. Yes. Now, there's been no description of what the words are. There's been no description of the person. But for some of us in the room, there's a being that comes into imagination that has certain qualities, that has certain characteristics. And an emotional response arises in response to sound waves coming out of my mouth. We do this all the time. At the end of the fascicle, Dogen told a story about about a master who claimed to have psychic powers. He could read minds. And a teacher was sent to see if this was so. And a teacher, Weizong, said, "Have you mastered the power of seeing others' minds?" Dare, the one who says he has psychic powers, says, "No, not really." And Weizong, the teacher, says, "Tell me where this old monk is." Dare says, "You're the teacher of the nation, Reverend. Why are you in the West River enjoying the racing boats?" Weizong paused for a while and said, "Tell me where I am now." Dare said, "You're the teacher of the nation, Reverend. Why are you on the Tianjin Bridge watching monkeys play?" Weizong again said, "Tell me where I am." Dare tried to see for some time, but could not see where Weizong was. So Weizong shouted, "You're possessed by the spirit of a wild fox. You don't have the power of seeing others' minds." Dare remained silent. So then Dogen then goes into a long exposition about what went wrong. And he lists many reasons of what went wrong and what different teachers have said in response and how they've missed. And what struck me in that conversation was there was a lot of assumptions made. Can you read my mind? Can you tell me? With what eye did Dare see the teacher? Maybe the fleshly eye, I'm guessing. They were together. Maybe the divine eye. But the prajna eye? The dharma eye? At no point was there inquiry. At no point was there an attempt at clarification. It was just, "I know you." We do that all the time, too. "I know you. We've been in the same space. I know who you are." We jump to conclusions. We jump to assumptions. We limit ourselves to the eye of flesh. So part of what we do in this practice is we aim towards clarity. We aim towards seeing past delusions and our habitual ways of clouding over our experience. We try to make ourselves feel more comfortable and usually end up causing suffering. Because the easy answer, the quick answer, usually is not the one that leads towards liberation. So often when I give a talk, it's focused on skillful means or ways of noticing how we react and respond. But it's also important to move from noticing reaction and behavior, these things that we do, to noticing what's underneath. Karmic responses will continue to arise and fall. But our karmic responses will continue until the root causes are seen through. So I'd encourage you to turn your eyes inward and find the causes of your suffering. Not in a theoretical way. Cut the bonds of illusion and move towards clarity. Fumio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering if you could clarify something for me. Talking about jumping to conclusions, I get nervous when I hear questions like, how do I make things disappear? Uh-huh. The Wisdom Sutras tell us things can't disappear. Mm-hmm. They don't rise and don't cease. Mm-hmm. Dogen makes a big point of this in Uji, saying that nothing disappears. Everything is there. Mm-hmm. Everything arises simultaneously in the moment. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with this? Can you clarify this idea of disappear from the group?
I think my answer in that moment was, things disappear when the causes for things to arise have ceased. So in this moment is this moment. Everything that exists this moment came from a cause, but there is no cause that leads to this thing. There's a lot of intense Buddhist philosophy around all of this, and there's different views and different arguments. So part of how I answer that question, it depends on the student.
Good. That's great. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Jishin, thank you for your talk. I've been rereading the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines recently, and so this is lovely. What was the name of the chapter that you read this week in Ginzoi? The Dogen.
Shin Fukatoku.
Yes.
Louder, slower.
Shin Fukatoku.
Thank you.
Or Undraftable Mind, depending on the translation.
Yeah, thank you.
And then another comment. I really like what you said about how we assume we know people. Mm-hmm. And we assume we get that, and we know where they're coming from, what's going on. And actually, seeing Yokiko, I thought of something you mentioned in a talk years ago now. And that still resonates for me, because as Portland gets more crowded, I get more irritated, and drivers get more impatient. And so, like, when people cut me off, you know, things like that, that urban causes, urban factors of living that can be so just tedious and triggering. And I remember you said years ago, what if you passed the person who cut you off and you saw they were crying?
Yeah.
Like, how would that change your heart? And so this idea that we know what's going on with people, they're just a jerk, they're an idiot, but we don't know going on. And thank you, that's a helpful reminder.
I have to confess, I found myself ruminating about some karmic perceptions and missed some of the Buddha eyes since
you were
talking about. I feel like I had to learn a loving eye for myself to connect to a body I had disconnected for a long time as a large woman and her child, and just many ways in which karma has disconnected me from my body. Mm-hmm. And what I needed to find was this loving eye, and I was curious, what eye would that be, perhaps? but loving my feet, loving all the pieces of me, and being able to hear what my body tells me it needs. I needed to find that one.
Yeah. And I think you could look through many different eyes with love towards your body. The divine eye sees the karmic aspects. The prajna eye sees the emptiness of it, that it is changing, that there is no inherent existence to that body. The prajna eye sees the suchness of it. Here it is now, how wonderful. So I don't think a loving eye is separate from the Buddha's five eyes, but all of the Buddha's five eyes.
I guess that would be Samantabhadra. The hidden, the great activity.
Thank you. Those eyes can see with love.
Yeah, thank you.
So I've been thinking for a long time about how I am always the protagonist in my story. Always. And, you know, I'm always the one that's moving through the world skillfully and reasonably and in a thoughtful, measured way. And right? And it's fill in the blank. Everybody else is doing it wrong. And causing me irritation or causing offense against me, right? So which I is that? And how do I put a fork through that eye so I don't have that eye anymore?
I think that's I 0.5. It's the physical eye. It's the fleshly eye. It's the eye that we with which we see our day-to-day life when we're going through the world. It's the eye that sees conventional reality through a distorted view.
It's boring, really. I mean, the story is so boring.
Watch a different movie.
I know. I've been trying ever since I got here. I'm still trying. I'm trying.
Change the channel. Yeah. Thank you, Thomas.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Joshin. When you were describing the hat, I had no idea. I thought, I'm pretty hip. I know what's going on. I have no idea what the hat said. When you were first saying it's a red hat, I think you said four letters, but you might have said four words. I was
four
thinking,
words.
Love? Santa? Wait, that has five. I had no idea. Like, kitty hat for the Women's March? But anyway, I thought it doesn't matter. I'm glad I don't know. I'm not judging it. But I really, you know, one of the reasons I don't have, like, tattoos or dye my hair crazy colors or, like, have bumper stickers on my car is I like to be kind of anonymous and nondescript so that people don't judge me when they see, you know, my dreads or my, you know, tie-dye or whatever. I mean, I kind of have some things on that people can judge today, but usually I'm pretty nondescript, I think. Or maybe I fit in and I'm just like, oh, you're mainstream or whatever. And so I have all these labels for myself, and then I realize I have them for other people, but they're not deep. You know, I don't hold to them. But I was just, as you were describing that, I realized my mind's curious. Like, I'm curious what is that hat, and what does it mean, and what does it say about the person? Mm-hmm. We had a woman at the Jewish Museum the other day who sat outside the window, and she had a swastika tattoo on her shoulder. Mm. And I just looked at it. She was a young girl, and she looked kind of out of it, like maybe on drugs. And so those tables are for our customers, and I had to go out and say something. So all the other young women in the museum were getting all excited, you know, like, oh, we got to do something, you know, and this is the education department comes down there, like, this is a really good moment for education for this person. And I was like, what are you going to go to say? And so I just went out and I asked if they needed anything. And oh, the man sitting with her had like bullets, like a belt with bullets on it. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, And I went out and I said, you know, would you like to order something? And they just looked at me like, no, we just sat here. We wanted to talk. And I said, well, it's kind of lunch hour right now. It's kind of the rush, and these tables are for our customers. Can I get you anything? And they looked in, and they realized where they were sitting. And they both just, like, froze, and they said, can we get some waters to go? And I was like, yeah. And so, but I went in, and they came out, and they ran away. And I just thought, I didn't judge the swastika so much, although we talked about how there's also a Buddhist symbol and other symbols that look like that. But I just, the reaction of everybody else in the museum was they were all really angry. really, really mad, and they wanted to go do something about it.
Yeah.
But they moved along because I was just polite to them and asked them. But I have, you know, I wonder, I'm so curious about the way that people judge one another, and I feel like I have a trigger kind of against that. I feel like, I was thinking, what if it was a person sitting there with like a Native American, kill Native Americans, you know, sticker. I would just think, I wonder what is going on with that person. What, you know, it's just so curious to me. I don't think I'd feel anger, but like, what's going on?
Yeah. We have a lot of habits in society around reacting. Judging, reacting, assessing. We're social creatures. Where do I fit in? How do I identify my tribe? How do I make myself known to my people? And different people value different ways of doing that. And yet we still look around. That's those people. These are my people. So part of the blessing of spiritual practice is we start to see some of that. We start to see how we do that. And yet, we still do it, right? Like, I can look around, who are my people? Now, who's got the shaved heads and the black hair? Oh, wait, a lot of you in the room are in black clothes. That's great. You're sitting still. Okay, that's familiar. That's comfortable. Those things that I identify with, seeing them causes me comfort. It helps me be at ease. Seeing something other than that, I might be a little uncomfortable. In a church with lots of colors and loud music and maybe an electric guitar in the choir, that might not feel so comfortable. And so then there's a distancing. And I rationalize that distancing with judgment. Oh, they're like that. But all of this happens so fast. We don't see the process of it. And one of the things that Buddhism is very good at is through meditation, breaking down those mental processes. Seeing how one thing leads to another, which leads to another, and then there's this result. So if you can cultivate curiosity instead of judgment and to remain open to, hey, what's this, as opposed to that is, I think that's a great habit to have. I wish more people had that capacity. That's part of, like, when I'm working with people in Sanzen, that's often a lot of what I recommend. Can you be curious about something? Can you say, what is this, as opposed to, that is bad, that is wrong. I am bad, I am wrong. So thank you for sharing that story.
So I just want to point out that sometimes, I learned this a long time ago, that sometimes stereotypes can be useful for us. It's one of the ways that the mind starts gathering information about an unknown and says and starts creating a picture, so you don't have to start from absolutely zero to figure out what's going on. But the problem is that when we get stuck on that, so it's like you say, if you also don't bring curiosity to it, if you hold it really tightly and say, this is what this person is, this hat definitely means this person is a Trump supporter, and whatever you feel about that, or whatever it is. I mean, it's a useful tool as long as we use it as a useful tool and one of the many sources of information we might be gathering about a person or a situation. And so part of what I find useful in Buddhist practice is that ability to stop and say, okay, here's what my mind is telling me. Some of it may be true. I wonder what else I need to know. Mm-hmm. So the instant sort of assessment stereotype isn't necessarily bad. It's just incomplete. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Joshin, for your talk. I felt myself go through just a whole range of emotions just in the span of your sharing. And I find it ironic that I had to catch myself in jumping to assumptions about the story and your experience and where it came from. And my initial reaction, was that there are some people who have the privilege of being able to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. And there are other people who don't have that privilege. Hence, for me, noticing that as a woman of color, mm-hmm. and acknowledging the immediate sympathetic nervous response that I have to that ability to blend in and be anonymous, I had to step back a moment. I had to step back a moment and figure out how to be in relationship with those five eyes.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I grapple with every day in my Buddhist practice, which I appreciate and am grateful for and also struggle with, is the relationship between this process of seeking clarity and understanding of the self and how we move through the world with right action, and how we connect this understanding with the very real suffering that's happening, and not relying simply on an individual level of understanding to create the change that we know might create more justice in the world. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm sitting with a lot of complicated feelings around how to engage my Buddhism.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing that. Thank you for sitting with those complicated feelings and giving yourself the time and the space to examine them, to work through them. It's so important to share our stories. In one sense, like in meditation, the instruction is often to drop the story, to let it go as we examine the mind. But we do not spend all day, every day in formal meditation. And in this world of social creatures, it is important to see each other, to see the emptiness that comes with, yes, my story too is part of the human experience that is shared, and the suchness of my story is unique and needs to be seen and honored and heard. And that's part of what we do in the fall when we do the fall term student program. We have an opportunity to build Sangha connections by sharing stories, by seeing each other, seeing the ways in which our stories are similar, even though appearances are different. Or to see the ways in which our stories are different, even though appearances are assumed to be similar. And it's hard work. It's very hard work. People are often exhausted at the end of the day. Any last questions?
Thank you for your talk. I hesitate sometimes to share because I have social anxiety, and even thinking about holding the microphone, my heart is just like racing. So sorry if I'm kind of shaky.
But you're doing it.
Yeah. One thing I've kind of noticed sometimes in like the socializing periods is, is I notice people having kind of open political discussions, and that's fine. But you know, no matter what our political views might be, I'm concerned that when someone comes in to our temple, that if they have a different view, for whatever reason that they have that view, they might feel excluded. And I felt kind of concerned, and I've wondered if I should, I wanted to say something, just say like, hey, you never know what other people are, what their beliefs are. You know, if I've definitely heard people say, talk about, you know, oh, the Chinese or something, and you never know, someone of that heritage could come in and they might feel excluded, just as an example. And so I'm kind of, that's something I kind of hope is that we can keep that in mind too, but I'm not sure how to respond skillfully sometimes.
Well, I think speaking up as you are right now is a skillful response. Saying that, hey, this is important to me is a skillful response. And facing your anxiety and holding a microphone shows that it's important. But this is something that happens. This is something that we're always balancing authenticity and skillfulness and being attentive to the needs of others and responding in the moment. So sometimes we do well and sometimes we don't.
Thank you.
Yeah, but remembering to err on the edge of kindness is helpful.